Steven, we're short an episode.
Oh, shoot, we are.
We got to put something in the feed.
Yeah, okay.
You can blame me.
Do you have anything that you can...
I could talk about Smash Bros. Things.
Ellen, do you have anything?
I can talk about dogs.
Okay, that's pretty good.
That's better.
I mean, there is this 90-minute conversation I had on an episode of Enterprising Individuals.
Okay.
Which is a Star Trek podcast.
Oh, gosh.
Which is, you know... I mean, we talk about two things on Nice Games Club, video games and Star Trek.
No. So, Mark, are you proposing we have...
I'm sorry. I've already pulled the lever. This is official now, Steven.
Oh, God.
We're going to be rebroadcasting this episode. It came out last week, if you're a subscriber to that show, Enterprising Individuals.
Cool.
Where we talked about Star Trek video games. Ah. So listeners to this program would know that we did an episode on Star Trek video games a couple years ago, and I cribbed a bunch of my notes from there, so it was pretty nice. But Aaron brought a lot of the conversation, too. It was really cool. We also talked a lot just about, you know, what Star Trek means and why it's different from other science fiction franchises, and I got to just say a lot of my piece about Star Trek. So that was a lot of fun. We asked them if they'd let us throw that episode in the feed, because, one, it's a good show. If you're into Star Trek, it's a good show to listen to. I think you should subscribe. So this is a bit of a taste of it. And also, as I said, we're short an episode, folks. So this is just going to be, you know, help plug a hole for us.
Yeah.
So it's solving a problem is all it's doing. It's not like a hostile takeover or anything.
Okay.
Ellen.
It's a friendly takeover. It's a nice takeover.
I got to invite some of my anti-Star Trek friends on here, I guess.
Do they even exist?
No.
All right. Well, without further ado, here it is, that episode of Enterprising Individuals.
Attention crew, this is your Captain Caliban speaking. This is a supplemental episode of Enterprising Individuals, where we bring you news and tidbits from the world of Trek, also interviews with special guests, and a few little surprises along the way. And we've got to get right into it today. Hold down X, we're skipping all the cutscenes. Star Trek is one of the most successful and diverse properties of all time, and that means that there's a lot of Star Trek video games. From the earliest text adventures to the VHS games of the 90s, all the way to Bridge Crew in VR today. But are there any good Star Trek games? Some would say no. I know I've certainly had a hard time finding them, but it really seems like Trek has all the elements that would make a good game, right? So what is the deal? Well, that's the question I put to Mark LaCroix. Mark is the co-host of the Nice Games Club podcast and a game developer, and we talked recently about the history of Star Trek in video games, what's happening in the industry currently, and why it's tough to make a standout game that really captures the feel of Trek. It was a fun discussion, and it generated many links that you may want to follow on the internet for more information, like the Nice Games Club homepage and more of Mark's work, or my own recent experiences with the Voyager game Elite Force, which you can see on YouTube. Please check out the show notes for those links. That's it for me this week. Enjoy my talk with Mark. Press A to violate Prime Directive. And with that, let's get underway. My guest on the show today is Mark LaCroix. Mark is a writer, editor, animator, and game designer whose work extends to short films, music videos, public art, and 3D printed sculpture. He also hosts a podcast about video game design called Nice Games Club, where nice game devs talk gaming and game development. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I always ask first-time guests to the show how they first discovered Star Trek. How did you become a Star Trek fan?
So I'm exactly the right age for the next generation, like the right age.
Yeah.
But that wasn't my first contact with Star Trek, which I watched the, you know, when TNG started, it was rolled into the syndication package of the original series.
Yeah.
So if you watched it in 1987, 88, you watched the new episodes mixed in with Kirk and Co. And so I was watching that, you know, strip syndication 5 nights a week on a little black and white TV in the spare bedroom. At like 10 at night, way past my bedtime. And so I became a fan of the original series. And I the first Next Generation episode I saw was Conspiracy with the exploding worms and everything. And I remember as a kid, I mean, I was just like, oh, well, I'm never watching that show again. And it's so funny because it only took about 6 months after that before I became a Next Generation super fan. But I have a very distinct memory of my first Next Generation episode being like being so turned off by it. And then reading later that Gene Roddenberry got some studio notes about how gross that stuff was in that episode and then upped the ante just to spite them. And then that taught me a very valuable lesson about not revering your heroes too much.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Not everybody listens to feedback or responds in the same way.
Yeah. Like, man, Gene, you could have got me 6 months earlier if you'd have been a bigger man about the whole thing. You know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's very similar to my story as well, and watching those blocks, you know, where they go, okay, here's a new show, and then, hey, why not? Here's the old show, and kind of discovering them at the same time. How did you get started in game design?
Well, I, as you alluded in my intro, which is a little bit outdated because I used to, you know, I'm a multi disciplinary artist, but right now I'm a game developer. That's what I'm doing these days. But I kind of fell into it because when I was doing a lot of work in design, film, media, I worked in advertising for a bit. All that's multidisciplinary. And the thing about video games is it's like the ultimate multidisciplinary art. And so it became a case where like, okay, I need to make some animation. So I'm working with Flash. Oh, you can code in Flash. Okay. Let me see how that works. And, I'm doing, motion graphics now and like, oh man, this task is taking this General Mills ad or whatever is taking forever. But look, I can put some code into my After Effects to streamline some of the way this animation works and do some like code-driven animation. And so everything I did led me to software development as a way to learn more about the thing that I wanted to do. And so eventually I just was like, you know, I should just focus on that. And so that's what I'm doing now.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. That's so interesting too. I think that like hopefully kids of new generations are getting this information about how they can get involved in game development, but also use those skills, you know, in other disciplines. Because when I was a kid, I thought, boy, I love video games. It'd be great to do video games. But like doing video games, that didn't mean anything to me. I had no idea how to make that into a reality. Even though you can get in through programming or design or writing, there's all these different ways that you can get into it. So I never did anything with that. But that's interesting that you can use those skills so well. It's also something that I've also found interesting is, you know, I've played video games as long as I can remember. If you're anything like me, and you might be, I mean, we're both white guy creatives of the same age who like radio and video games and live in the same state, then you probably felt that thing that I did growing up, which was that like my hobbies are shameful. Did you ever get that? Like liking video games or comic books as a kid, it's tolerated when you're young. But when you become an adult, it's like, oh boy, what happened to that guy? He still likes video games.
I would say I read X-Men a little bit as a kid, and I did like video games. I mean, I had a Nintendo, but I was a kid in the early 90s. So, QED. But I think it was just Star Trek was like my only nerd thing. And so I had all the action figures and I had many of the board games and video games, and we'll get into that. But, but then when I got into high school, it was like, oh, Star Trek was that, and Star Trek was still on at that point. And it was like, Star Trek was that thing I loved as a kid. And I never shied away from telling people I loved Star Trek as a kid. And it was just this little black hole of my life where it felt like a little too nerdy to still be super into. Like I put away my dog-eared copy of the Star Trek Encyclopedia. I didn't throw it away. I was never rejected it, but for a little while, it wasn't part of my personality. And then in college, I got a T1 connection in my dorm room and basically binged DS9 in the way you did in those days, which was downloading the episodes illegally. Yeah, and, from then until now, so the past 20 years, Star Trek has now become again part of my personality. But there was a time when it felt like, I love that thing, but like it's not like, okay, we don't need to talk about it. But I didn't have that with a lot of other things because I guess I always felt like a nerd because I love Star Trek so much. But I didn't actually, a lot of the other things I didn't have to that same degree. So hearing a lot of people's story about growing up nerds and then now it becoming the mainstream, I don't feel as connected to that because Star Trek is actually still not quite mainstream in the same way. Star Trek fandom is not quite mainstream, even though Star Trek is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that, obviously Trek is experiencing a renaissance now. And because everybody has to be so private about their streaming numbers and their subscribers, it remains to be seen how many of the new viewers are, new converts to Trek, quote unquote, normal people who are watching Star Trek. It's certainly true that, you know, in the last heyday of Star Trek in the late 80s and early 90s, everybody watched Star Trek. Like you didn't have to be a Star Trek nerd. TNG was just like family viewing, at 8 o'clock. And so I think that's interesting. That's an interesting point to make about whether or not Star Trek fans are as mainstreamed as some other nerd fans. You know, I think you can wear, and any old person can wear a Wolverine or definitely a Punisher shirt, you know, on the street and be fine. But is Star Trek, have they made the big time just yet? I don't know.
You know, I do wonder if it's about the thing that, and I mean, I'm biased, I think, but like the thing I like about Star Trek that I don't like about Star Wars, I don't like about a lot of other things, and some things approach, but Star Trek is the only franchise with an ideology. Like, it has a point of view that is so core to its being that it kind of escapes the Spock on a t-shirt. You know what I mean? Like, you can have Wolverine on a t-shirt, and like, even though there are like themes in X-Men, right? And like, and that's pretty powerful for kids growing up reading that comic. You know, I'll give that more credit than I give something, say, like Star Wars, which is really just about itself these days. But like, but with Star Trek, I think the pop culture presence of Star Trek became mainstream, but that core, what it's about, I think that's why you always hear in interviews people remind you what it's about. Like, because I think it's one of those things that is a little harder to stick with a general audience. And, you know, there are parts of like the J.J. Abrams movies, the first one and particularly the third one, that actually do really hold true to that Star Trek message. But that has nothing to do with why those movies were as popular as they were, I think. And so I think, I think that's a little different with Star Trek. So, but it might just be because I'm so in it that when I see people just saying like, oh yeah, transporters and phasers, I'm like, that's not Star Trek, you know? And it's like maybe just me thinking like, oh, it's not mainstream because people don't quite get it the way that we, you know, lifelong devotees do.
That's interesting. Like that comment about, you know, in interviews, it's always going to get brought up that Star Trek is about, you know, acceptance and diversity or whatever. So yeah, maybe Star Trek for some people always represents homework or a sermon of some kind, and maybe that keeps them away. I guess I wouldn't change it, but yeah, I would like to see an article or two about somebody just talking about, you know, maybe the phasers or something, you know, or like cool the Cardassians are or something like that.
You know, like I said, I had the dog-eared copy of the first edition of the Star Trek Encyclopedia. I love the trivia, I love the props, I love the world building. That was a big part of my experience with Star Trek. Mm-hmm. But I feel very strongly that the morality and that homework really shaped me as a kid.
Oh yeah, me too.
In a way that I'm like, I'm much more dismissive of pop culture these days because it doesn't meet that standard. Yeah. And I don't know if that's fair or not, or if it's really just me like expressing my preferences or interests and not something bigger than that. But sometimes it feels bigger than that. Like, you know, I'll take a phaser fight and a great transporter sequence. But you know, it's one of the things, and again, it comes up in these interviews all the time. It's almost, you have to just, the actors, producers, writers, and Gene Roddenberry would always say things like, remember, it's about the human adventure. Almost as if like people kept mistaking it, or they kept worrying that people wouldn't understand that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they had to put a coat of paint on it, which also isn't fair because that coat of paint is part of what brings out the flavor, right? Or whatever. Those are mixed metaphors, but you get what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, it also goes on into adulthood, I think, too. It's because all children's entertainment, I think, is inherently moralizing.
Yeah.
That's just what we do. But yeah, as you grow up and become an adult, you grow up with those sort of lessons, but it continues like post-grad work. You know, into adulthood, where I'm still looking for sci-fi that does that. And if I watch something else, I might enjoy it, but like the characters will make a decision, I'd be like, whoa, Captain Picard never would have done that.
Well, that's why The Next Generation is better than, say, Battlestar Galactica, because it's a kid's show and you can go back to it as an adult, right? I as a kid also, I didn't watch a lot of children's programming because I had Star Trek. And that kind of did it for me, you know? But like, you know, like Battlestar Galactica, even something like The Expanse, which is, I think more, has more going on than, say, Battlestar Galactica did. There's something about it being available for a wide audience that you don't have to make your properties so narrow and so focused and so niche. And I get, I'm not, it's kind of weird because it's a little contradictory, right? Like Star Trek is so specific and so nerdy, but it also is for everyone in a way. Mm-hmm. And that's why, like, I really, really love that, like, they're doing Star Trek Prodigy. And I love that Lower Decks is something that, you know, so true to the spirit of Star Trek, but is kind of a little bit more all access in terms of, you know, who's targeted at than say Discovery or Picard, which I also like, but, you know, have problems with. But, you know, at my age, I'm like, any Star Trek. I'll take any Star Trek. Yeah, you know what sure. I mean? It doesn't even be good. I'll just more Star Trek is good because it all has that core in it. And so I'm, you know, I think that there's a about like what is worth making these days. Like when the 2009 movie came out, I'm like, this isn't exactly the best version of Star Trek, but it's Star Trek and it's got a little bit in there. So like, my standards ultimately are very low when it comes to Star Trek, even though there are a lot of Star Trek episodes that I really hate because they don't meet the standards of Star Trek. You know,
it's a sci-fi franchise with high standards itself, but your standards for it are low. And that's A-okay.
It's all nuanced and complicated and contradictory. And that's what comes from it being part of your personality.
I wonder if all Star Wars fans like love Star Wars for the same reasons, but all Star Trek fans love Star Trek for a different reason.
I do wonder about that because Star Wars has a different relationship between its like prime canon and its extended canon.
Yeah.
Like even now when there are multiple television shows for Star Wars, like I think their audience is probably a little more diverse in terms of its interest and what brings it to it than it say used to be. But I think, but Star Trek is so big and for so much for everyone and has so many different avenues and flavors and stuff that I think that is, and that's another thing that's great about Star Trek. As long as we're just talking about what's great about Star Trek is that like something can hook you, but then there's other stuff in there to keep you, you know, the way that I think Star Wars kind of, it surfaces a lot of its big themes and big, you know, stuff on top. And it kind of takes some digging, I think, to get to anything else.
Yeah. I think that one of the challenges for Star Trek going forward into the 21st century is letting its fans, giving its fans different aspects of it to enjoy. Like if the core of Star Trek, whether it's, you know, cartoon aliens or if it's people on a space station or on a spaceship, it's always that same idea of, you know, a utopian future that we have to maintain and examine and that sort of thing. And whereas Star Wars is like, no, we can have cartoon stormtroopers or we can have a series of short films that are like based on anime. Like we can deliver you all these different sort of views and looks at it. If Star Trek, you know, the more it expands and the more that it creates new entries into its franchise, if it can kind of find newer, fresher aspects. I think that would be, you know, if it can diversify what it's delivering, I think that's probably the best way to go forward. Because Star Trek has mostly just been Star Trek for 50 years. Like it's just, you know, a bunch of people somewhere confronted with something that is a metaphor for something, and then they have to figure out what to do with it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's that contradiction again. It's like, there's so much going on in Star Trek, but it is so single-minded. It drills down to that core ideology in a way that like other franchises can be the lens by which you could tell any story. I think there are certain Star Trek episodes where like you hear like a sexist joke or something, kind of like a sitcom-y, you know, a sexist joke of its era. And it weirdly doesn't reflect on Star Trek. It basically, you kind of just feel like, oh, that's bad Star Trek. Right. That's not like,
that's true.
It's not Star Trek is that. It's kind of, it's a weird hall pass it gets, frankly. It's like, because Star Trek is always trying and you get to, and it evolves in a way that nothing else does. Like if some franchise makes a mistake, they have to retcon it into making sense.
Yeah.
Star Trek, as much as, you know, dog-eared copy of the Star Trek Encyclopedia, they will throw crap out. And I kind of like that they are able to just, you know, like you were never going to hear where no man has gone before any longer. It's where no one. And it's like that change was made in 87 and it felt a little bit of its time in terms of the kind of like what progress meant was that sort of superficialness. But like we've seen prequels since and like, you know, I think maybe they did it on Enterprise, but like, you know, we just decided that we're done with that phrase, even though it was so core to what Star Trek was. Even if we go back to those eras, it's where no one has gone before now. And I think that's a key example of like what Star Trek cares about in a way that like other franchises, they can't get a foothold because there's nothing at the center of it as much, right? Not to, you know, I'm obviously praising Star Trek. I don't mean to denigrate everything else, but they just, nothing else has it, you know?
Yeah. I love that idea that Star Trek just gets away with it when like, oh no, it's Rick Berman's fault. Or, you know, there's just always some reason why
somebody
fell short of the Star Trek ideal. It's never that like, oh, maybe the Star Trek ideal wasn't completely developed as we think of it.
Yeah. And it's sad in a way that you get to sort of like, it doesn't reflect as badly on the franchise that maybe it should, but it also means that there's no one hanging on to it. You know, we can just move past anything it did wrong and just, we don't need to carry it with us to the next thing. We don't need to roll it in. We don't need to make references to those things just to make sure that the canon is consistent. As much as we are the original nitpickers, like, I think we're most free to get rid of it, to just ignore the stuff that we don't like. You know,
there's a fascinating parallel there too with what the people on Star Trek are trying to achieve. I didn't know we were going to dive this far into what Star Trek is all about.
Well,
but
you don't,
I love it.
You don't know me very well, but this is the okay. conversation to go.
But like the idea of, you know, the Federation and the very fallible beings who have organized and made it, and mm-hmm. I'm sure, you know, we don't always see it on screen, but in their own personal lives and in their dealings, probably fall short. But they have this ideal of the Federation that they want to be. You know, provide equality and egalitarianism, you know, to everybody in the universe, regardless of how they look or what they do or what they think or believe. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure personally they fall short of that, but they're always thinking about that ideal. And I think that Trek in our world represents that as well. When you get a sexist thing in TOS, you think, well, that's just a certain writer, or it was just a certain time. But we still have this ideal of what Trek is, and every show and every new entry takes that, you know, that template and goes, how close do we fit to that template? We need to fit within that template.
Yeah. And it lets us hate an episode of Star Trek and not hate Star Trek.
Yes.
You know, like yeah. the season 4 episode of Enterprise Bound, which is maybe the worst thing committed to film. I still like Star Trek. Like it didn't cause any damage. You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. Right.
In terms of my love for what Star Trek is now, if most of Star Trek becomes that over time, if Star Trek, gives in to, bad impulses, or just every episode is garbage going forward, I will maybe stop watching it, but I'll never stop loving Star Trek because of that, what's at that core. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good, it's got its own mission statement built in.
Yeah.
Like, nerds being sidelined is a thing of the past, or is becoming a thing of the past, I think. And comic books and nerd stuff have moved into the mainstream, and especially video games, which are now a billion-dollar industry. I think domestically, video games made $37 billion last year, which is more than movies, even without COVID as a factor. And I guess when I was growing up, I never thought that I would see the day that like video games outstrip movies in terms of their earning potential, but that's kind of the world that we're living in now.
Yeah, and actually, it happened quite a while ago, in a sense. Like, I've been making video games for I'm late as a game developer. This is my second career, and so I've been making games for about 5 years, and I feel like I've been reading that story about how like games are bigger than movies.
Right.
Then for like 20 years. Yeah. And because it's still so unbelievable the place it lives in our culture is still feels a little bit outside of the mainstream, even though everyone has an Xbox, you know?
It is.
And I don't know. Part of it's like, oh, let's get over it already. But I'm like, I don't know. I think in 20 more years, we're still going to be surprised by that because of just how different games really are in terms of how you experience them. They're a much more personal medium. So you can talk with your friends about them or whatever, but like, it's just less, they're harder to talk about in terms of like the sort of word of mouth, and they're harder to make sort of like cultural references reaching a mainstream audience. Video game memes get shared within the fans of that game. Games take 40 hours to play, so you don't play as many of them as you watch movies in a year. And so like even though it represents a huge part of our culture, it's not quite the same as movies. And I think we will continually be surprised by that, even when it dwarfs it by a hundredfold, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. I was just thinking two things. One, I don't know what percentage of that number is mobile gaming, or even like cell phone gaming, something that a person would do but not consider themselves. You know, they'll play Candy Crush all day long and not think of themselves as a gamer. And also the idea that, sure, there are trends that come and go in films, but ultimately you're still going to sit down and watch a movie for 2 hours, whether it's a Western or a romance or a comedy, and eat popcorn. Whereas in a video game space, you could be sitting down and just playing Resident Evil for a couple hours, or you could be putting on a VR rig and knocking over potted plants in your living room, or, you know, you could be playing World of Warcraft for 18 hours straight. Like, the way that everybody interfaces with the medium of entertainment is completely different than something like movies.
Yeah, it comes in more, there's more dimensions to it for sure. And I think the what genre is in a video game is very different than what it is in other media. Yeah. Because games have that extra dimension of like, oh, this is a Western, but it's a shooter. And I think when like my tastes in movies, I'm like, I like science fiction. I like contemporary drama. I don't like fantasy. Okay, fine. Those are my tastes of genres.
Yeah.
But in video games, it's not quite the same thing. And I think especially people who are like really hardcore PC gamers, they care less about settings and themes and story, even though they love settings and themes and story, right? Yeah. They like shooters. They like action games. They like visual novels. They like narrative heavy RPGs, but they don't care what they're about. Do you know what I mean? And I think that's because games require practice and they require familiarity with mechanics and control schemes and they're machines you step into. And so it's harder to say like, oh, I love science fiction, so I'm going to try this game in a game genre I've never heard of on a machine I've never played.
Yeah.
That takes me 40 hours. That's a harder sell, even though I would be the perfect person because the themes are so great, which is one of the reasons why, I mean, as an indie developer, you know, the games I make are smaller. And as someone who tries to, and someone inspired by Star Trek, I'm much more interested in themes and setting and story and how game mechanics can reveal those things rather than be something that those things just live in as a coat of paint. And I think that's one of my biggest problems with games right now is they feel trivial and they feel less like an art form to a lot of people because that marriage doesn't always happen. That doesn't mean that it's less of an art form, because a game with great mechanics with a bad story is still a work of art, or vice versa. But I think we don't take certain gamers take one part seriously and not the other, and vice versa on there. It's if you take both seriously, you are so picky, there's a very few video games you could even play.
Yeah, that's true.
And so it's hard. It's hard to be into video games and actually be able to express your own tastes the way it is for other mediums. And so I think that's part of why we don't think of it in the same way.
That's interesting. Well, going off of that logic, do you have a favorite genre of video game that you like to play?
I don't know. I love Mario. Like, it's hard to, it's such a cliche answer, but like, I like games where you play a controller like an instrument, you know, where there's like three buttons, but it's complicated. I don't like games where there are 50 different inventory slots. I don't like MMOs. I don't like fighting games where like the systems are so complicated. I much prefer elegant systems with like mechanical depth, if that makes sense. And Mario games are very simple, but they actually do have quite a lot of depth in terms of how you experience them. And they're bereft of story. Like there's so little going on there that those mechanics, you sort of get into the groove of a Mario game, and then there's a few of them that will sort of drip you a little bit of theme. But it's so subtle. And I think that's great. I think there's multiple approaches. So like the games I want to make, I want to just drown in story and theme and concept. I want people to walk away with ideas, but I still love Mario games, right? Like there's space for both.
Yeah. I think that like fans of video games would know that for a long time, the forward progression of video games, or at least the way in which video games were charted or measured, was by the technical specifications, more powerful processors, better graphics, more content, seemingly leading up to an experience like perhaps VR, where the game is something approaching akin to reality. But in recent years, retro gaming, that is games that take their design from earlier generations, have become very popular, as well as like retro and lo-fi aesthetic.
Yeah.
What's behind that trend, in your opinion? Have we given up on games being super realistic?
I think, well, there's two parts to it. One is that tools are more democratized, right? I mean, like currently I have a license with Nintendo. I can publish games on Xbox. Like I have a lot of access these days, but I wouldn't have been able to get any of that if I didn't have those free tools and free access and open marketplaces that democratized game development. I think getting a PS2 dev kit in the early 2000s, I mean, that was not something an indie could do.
No.
But now it's, if you have an idea and you have a little bit of, I mean, I, I brought a lot of the skills from my first career into my second. So I feel like I had a little bit of a head start, even though I started late. Anyone can make a Switch game. Like, I love that. I love that so much. Like, now that I have a little bit of access and feel a little bit more part of this industry, I'm still so strongly in favor of opening those doors and lowering those walls so that more people can get in, even though that means competition for me. And so the trend of like retro style gaming is that games can be smaller because it's easier to start making them. There's no need for every game to be big. So one of the benefits of improved graphical fidelity, faster processors, all that technical stuff that we consider, like, you know, how much grimmer and darker and deeper and more shiny is the next Doom going to be, is what we thought in the early 2000s. That's what we thought we were headed towards.
All that
means is you have all this overhead to play with, which means indie developers don't have to be great programmers. You know, I like to think of myself as fairly competent, but like, I don't have to be like, you know, and that's what's great about this medium is that because it is so multidisciplinary, which is so core to the way I feel as an artist, is like the interrelation of different concepts. And what that means is you actually can't spend 20 years being devoted yourself to expertise in any one of them. You gotta learn them all, and you gotta do them now.
Yeah.
And so what that means is that means smaller games with, you know, using all the advanced tools to sort of get some minimal viable on some of those aspects, so that you can focus on what the game you're working on is important, whether that's the story, whether that's like the art. You can have lovely, gorgeous art and very simple mechanics, and that's a great game.
Yeah.
You can focus on what's important to you, and that, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom, right? It's IDIC, right? It's just all sorts of games. And that's what's great about that bar being lifted, is that you can make more graphically high-end games, but also you can make anything else, more than you could in the old days.
Well, Star Trek has a long and very interesting history of video games. Everybody's personal mileage always varies, but I think it's held generally that Star Trek games are often not all that great. There have been some good ones, some successes in the early generations of gaming, especially on PC, but I think it's fair to say that there are no truly great modern Trek games, and certainly no like AAA Trek titles.
Well, I mean, I was going to say correct, because Star Trek has a history of making kind of garbage games. There are a couple notable examples of good ones over time, but I would say there are, you know, I've prepared a list that I'm not sure how much we're going to get into, but there are a couple that are out now that I would say rank amongst properly good games and properly good Star Trek as well. But you're not wrong. Star Trek has a well-deserved reputation for licensed works that don't quite understand what makes video games interesting. Either they try to be too Star Trek-y, or just completely fall down on that because they're not good games, and so they can't deliver a good Star Trek.
Yeah.
Or they try to be too video gamey, and then what's the point? They just become middling versions of more popular stuff you can just get elsewhere. That is a well-deserved reputation. But I think there's a couple that are around now that I think are pretty good.
Well, we'll get into the history of Trek games and some examples in a minute, but I think there's a lot of elements in Trek that fit very naturally into video games. Strong protagonists and weird aliens and cool space tech. You've got the convention of phaser combat and starship combat. But why do you think, in your opinion, it might be difficult to get a Star Trek game right?
I think it's the same thing we were talking about at the top of the show, which is that like Star Trek has this core ideology, and like it's a licensed property, right? So when the way this works, like logistically, is that I'm Paramount, I own Star Trek, I'm gonna let a video game company make a Star Trek game. Suddenly it's this outside creative team who maybe don't understand Star Trek very well. Maybe they think they understand it just fine, and maybe they do understand it okay, but they have no experience producing it. And so I think it's hard to get that core, what Star Trek is, into video games. So there's like the example I'm thinking of is Elite Force, which was a first person shooter set in you're a member of a Voyager security team, and it's just Quake 3 but Voyager.
Yeah,
and it has actually some interesting components to it, which is that you can your character, you can pick the gender of your character, which in the 90s pretty rare. And so for that reason alone, that's a little, that's kind of a Star Trek-y thing, right? For that era, right. Where, you know, I mean, Star Trek games after that weren't as good on that score, but the game itself, there's very little to it. You know, on the other hand, you have games where like they want to tell a whole Star Trek story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just the games, they're not good. I think that the NES and, Super NES and Game Boy, Star Trek games, from original series, Next Generation themed ones from that era, they're hard to use. They feel like PC games, like really finicky PC games from the 8-bit era mapped onto a console. And like you read captain's logs and there's like some non combat components, and it just never comes together. And so like it's just too hard to get into. There's a few examples where like you can, where it sings on both dimensions, but they are rare.
There's a concept in game design called the gameplay loop, which is essentially what you're asking the player to do in the game. And often the success of the game hinges on how satisfying you can make that loop and how well you can kind of conceal from the player that they're doing it over and over again.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there is a ideal gameplay loop or series of loops for a Star Trek game.
Well, I think a good example of this is the Star Trek Bridge Crew, which is a virtual reality game that came out just a few years ago, and became very popular because it's a properly good game. And in the game, you put on a headset, and it's a multiplayer game. You can play it by yourself, it's not as fun. You play with people online, or if you're lucky enough to have multiple headsets or have friends with headsets, you can all get in a living room and shout out. I've done that. It's hilarious. But basically, everyone has their own station, and you participate in a battle. It's a very kind of an arcade kind of game. So you think, well, that's not very Star Trek. It's mostly ship battles, you know, mostly routing energy, which is a Star Trek thing, but doesn't really fit the core of Star Trek. But the thing about Star Trek Bridge Crew, it's all about communication and cooperation, and that's what makes it work. And I think that loop is basically okay. Problem happens, engineer needs to reroute some energy so that the engines can move fast, but you have the captain who's directing people and putting up markers on the map. And it's just that sort of like everybody working together kind of feel, even though the tasks are very simple. You know, certainly it's kind of escape room like in a sense that sort of everyone has their part, and you have to make sure that everyone knows what's going on. And a lot rides on the captain's ability to explain what's happening, and a lot rides on people's ability to just take an action when they feel that they have the most information to act, but also to let other people tell them what to do, which is that's a life skill, you know. And it's a very those loops are over and over and over in that game, like, you know, bank left, you know, charge the phasers, you know, half impulse. So it feels fun. It feels a little theme parky. You have to play act Star Trek. So that's fun. But the mechanics really reinforce the theming, and it does it with a very tight gameplay loop. So I have a lot of praise for that game.
Nice. I don't have a VR set. I own the game, and you know, I can play it with a controller, but it's not quite as fun than the VR set.
Yeah, it's the same game, but that VR immersion like adds to it, right? It's this. I mean, you know, obviously there's more going on. You know why it's more exciting. It's in VR, but like you are literally doing the same things, and yet it feels 100 times more real.
Yeah.
I'm glad they added the ability to play in non-VR because it opens up to more people, especially in multiplayer environments.
Yeah.
You've really got to play that in VR.
Well, as we get into talking about Star Trek video games, we should probably mention literal video games, and that's the Star Trek VHS game that came out in the 90s. Star Trek: The Next Generation Klingon Challenge, the VCR board game. Kids today will never know about VHS board games, and that's probably okay.
Yeah, I think we're better off. I think we've passed through that rocky era better. We've learned our lesson, basically. I have two copies of that game. My wife had one, and I had one, and we both saved it. Because it had a big sticker with a collector's number on it, which was Paramount did with all their licensed properties, is like they put a sticker on it and put a number. Doesn't mean anything, and the number will go to infinity. But like,
it's a collectible.
Give it some value. Yeah. And so in our living room and our bookshelf, we just have two copies of it because we can't bear to get rid of one of them.
Yeah, that's I used to have I never had that one. I had the Clue game. And it became such a problem or such a hassle to just, like, my sister and I never agreed on anything, so we could barely ever sit down to play it. But so I ended up just like watching all the scenes all the way through. And, you know, I gained a new appreciation for what was clearly a bunch of, you know, community theater level actors, you know, being asked to play out all these scenarios in this different Clue game.
Well, in the Star Trek one, you get Robert O'Reilly not playing Gowron. But he plays another Klingon. And what's hilarious is they give him a different Klingon forehead piece. Because that's how much the Star Trek production cares.
Yes. Just use that mold that we've already got. Yeah.
Yeah. They're like, oh, we have all this stuff for you. We can just like, no. This is a different character. Now, Robert O'Reilly did not play it very differently. He did the Gowron eyes and everything. But it's just him on the sets with no other characters. It was shot very economically, probably on a weekend, during the fifth season or whatever. You can watch it all on YouTube, by the way. If you a Klingon challenge, you can look it up, and it's the only way you can play the game now, really. But for people who don't know, VCR board games are you start the tape, and it's just a looping background, nothing's going on, and you play this board game, and occasionally a scene will pop up that tells you to do something, and the gameplay is differently every time, just by the fact that you are at a different stage of gameplay when those scenes pop up, even though of course they pop up at the same time every time. Now, you know, that illusion only lasts so long. You can play it three or four times before you start to like, okay, I get it now. I can see past the smoke and mirrors. But it was kind of clever. I give them some credit.
Yeah, it's it was a new technology, and people were trying to think of like ways to integrate. I don't know if there was ever like, were there DVD board games?
Yes, yeah. I think that era, I'm trying to think, because VCR board games, you know, early mid 90s, novelties, then there was a couple of bigger ones, like horror themed games, like sort of party game style ones that were a little more popular. And then they went into the DVD era, and then I think probably died out pretty soon, 2002, 2003, I think was when they stopped being something that would be a more of a sure bet. You know, the novelty wore off, I think.
Yeah.
There was there were games. There's a game called Scene It, like the movie scene.
Yeah,
where it's Trivial Pursuit, but you watch DVD clips, kind of like Jeopardy style, where they show you a video clue. And that was sort of interesting. I mean, I don't know why people haven't revised that in like the Chromecast era. You know, where you can cast media. Yeah. I think that would be a good. Maybe I should get on that.
I think there's an app. There's like a Scene It sort of app based type game.
Oh, there must be. Yeah. I guess I don't know how popular that is, but it could be a billion-dollar industry. Like there's so many facets to video games. There's just a lot that any one of us doesn't know about.
Well, the earliest Trek video games were entirely text-based, like Zork, and kids today will never know Zork, yada, yada, yada. Games like Star Trek, Super Star Trek was another one. You know, throughout the 70s and 80s, there was a whole slew of probably unlicensed Trek games, speaking of indie developers. And they were written in BASIC or on DOS that featured text adventures and ASCII graphics.
Yeah, I think there's a famous one for Apple II. And I'm trying, or maybe the Apple One even. And I'm like, was that licensed? Like, how could that be licensed?
Yeah.
Like who made that phone call? Like, back in those early 8-bit computer days, like, I don't know. But I guess maybe someone just made that phone call. I don't know.
It's possible. Or it's possible they just went for it and didn't bother. Yeah.
Right. Market's small enough. Who cares? Right.
Yeah.
Those days are gone.
Those days are definitely gone. And these are like really nerdy games for Trek nerds. Like, they're not really reaching the mainstream, but the kind of person who would, have four or five floppies to install this sort of thing are the people who are looking for these kind of games too.
Yeah. Yeah. The that era of computer games is so interesting because it was really PC based, right? Like consoles. Yeah. There were the Atari consoles that industry crashed in the early 80s. And but what kept going was PC games, and Nintendo brought it back. It's a very small period of time, but like it allowed a lot more like creativity because like there was arcade games that was for action games, but PCs were not powerful enough to make do action games. So designers had to design games that would work on these machines. And that meant slower paced, more strategic, more text, which meant more story. And so those kind of limitations, I was talking earlier about like how many of those limitations have been lifted, but they still guide us in terms of the things we can make. And, as an artist, I was like, let's making something in a box, is much more fulfilling than making something, without any limitations at all. And so it's interesting, like that era produced a lot of really interesting experiments that, influenced games as, through that era, even though you wouldn't recognize them necessarily as such.
Yeah. There's an interesting line of spin-off games from those early Star Trek games called the Starfleet universe by Trevor Sorensen.
Yes, that's the Starfleet battles. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that, oh, that is such a great story. It's the, like they licensed Star Trek as of 1979. So I think it might have included the first movie, but maybe not. And it's a I guess there was a video game version, but like the it was a tabletop tactical like wargaming kind of thing.
Yeah.
Not like D&D, but more like Warhammer. Mm-hmm. And then you know, I guess they had no idea that there would be more Star Trek, right? Like maybe they'd make a movie or two, but in that era they're like we know what Star Trek is.
Yeah.
But the license didn't include any new work. So as Star Trek diverged and made new movies and TV shows, this thing developed its own fiction that spun off. And so it's just called the Starfleet universe. It's so bizarre to me. It's fascinating, though.
There's a whole Wikipedia article about it. And I think they're still, until fairly recently, they're still sort of developing and making new entries into it as far as.
Yeah, and it has its own history and its own, like, mm-hmm. you know, it has its own fans of its own unique lore that built on Star Trek. And when I was looking into this a while back for an episode we did of Nice Games Club, which is where a lot of my notes come from. I didn't generate these new. when I was looking into this, the thing that fascinated me most was looking into reading a lot of the lore and how very focused on military strategic territory control. It felt very World War II in a way, very History Channel in a sense that a lot of the story was geared towards the type of gameplay that this universe was part of. And it really made me, I mean, one, I find that much inferior to the lore developed for proper Star Trek, naturally. But it is interesting on how like form follows function in a way. And I think that's something with, as a game developer, you have to think of, like the kind of story you want to tell. Like it needs to make sense with your mechanics, and your mechanics should derive the kind of story you want to tell. So if you want to make a first person shooter that's all about love and understanding, like good luck, you know, you can do it, I guess, but it's not going to be effective either as a shooter or as a story. And, you know, I mean, someone will come up with a way, but I think Starfleet Battles is a definite example because you have a case study of like what happens to a storyline of fiction when it's governed by essentially seen entirely through the lens of wargaming, you know?
Yeah. Which is not ostensibly that element exists in Trek, but it's not really the focus of Trek. Yeah.
Lots more, heroes on the bridge going out in a flame of glory kind of heroism and right. less the leaning over a microscope heroism that we like to think is a little more Star Trek, you know?
Yeah. We should probably talk about Star Trek arcade games. And the first Star Trek arcade game came out in 1983. Star Trek Arcade, also called Strategic Operations Simulator, was a vector graphics game very similar to 1983's Star Wars, which came out in arcades the same year. You ever played this game?
No, I'm trying to think of any Star Trek. I played a Voyager arcade game that was like a
light gun
shooter.
Voyager light gun. Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I'm probably a little. I'm too young for a lot of those earlier games.
I was lucky enough to find a retro arcade that had Star Trek Arcade played it. And it's if you've ever seen or played a version of the old Star Wars arcade game, it's very similar to that.
So is all of the Star Trek of it like on the decals on the side of the cabinet, or is there any of the art, the vector art, does it actually feel like it looks like Star Trek at all?
Actually, it does. They've got a precedent in the movies, right? Like in, I think, Wrath of Khan, you see some vector graphics. And so those are kind of translate to the game. Like you're fighting Klingon warbirds and they look similar to what you see in the graphics in the films and stuff like that.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of a neat game.
Yeah.
I don't know how much a cabinet it is, but if I was going to make a big purchase, I'd totally go for that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you mentioned, there was a Borg arcade game. There was a Voyager a light gun arcade game. And recently, we were talking about VR before. Recently, there's been a couple Star Trek VR games that have come out in limited release. There was a Star Trek Discovery Away Mission VR experience. And that's one of those ones where you have to, it's not going to be in an arcade. You have to go to like a, you know, VR experience company.
Oh, that's so interesting. So
with a dedicated room, yeah.
Literally, the most recent example, or the most recent episode of Nice Games Club was with a designer, Dana Ware. She worked at The Void, which was one of those companies that made these things. Yep. And we talked to her about designing for those kinds of experiences. I don't know. They did a Star Wars one, I know. I don't think they did that Discovery one.
Okay.
But yeah, that's been on my mind recently. That kind of those kinds of like more location based kind of VR experiences.
Yeah.
What's different about than from when you're like you touch a prop in your living room that's virtual and you fall over because you think it's not there.
Right.
In these places, they build plywood boxes for you to actually lean against for a virtual thing.
I've seen a video and it is an escape room type situation.
Yeah.
Also, Dave & Buster's did Dark Remnant, which is a VR game/ride that focuses on it's just a shooter experience, more or less. I've actually played this one. I wrote an article about it for a website, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You sit down in like a sled type thing, you know, with 10 or 12 seats, and it moves around, and you're it's a Star Trek 2009 era type scenario with. I think the celebrity voices do the talent or do the voice talent too.
Oh, cool. Yeah. It's interesting how some of these like are like promotional, right? They're very tied to, you know, there's a couple of those in the 90s that were, you know, tied to the launch of, you know, I think the DS9 Genesis game was launched like to help promote DS9 in 93. Yeah. But a couple of these, they feel a little bit more event style or pop-up, right? They're like you said, limited release because they're meant to just be part of a marketing budget, perhaps.
Yeah. Right.
Less meant to sit on a shelf forever, you know?
Yeah. And with the closure of a lot of arcades in 2020, I have no idea if that still exists.
Yeah. I mean, the Void shut down over the pandemic. It's been really rough. Like, there's gaming conventions that I'm not going to that. Yeah. I'm just reading a lot about how like people are trying to find ways to like make VR demoable again. And, you know, I mean, not to get too much into pandemic talk, but like surface transmission is different from what we thought it was a year ago. But all of our thinking about wiping everything down urgently is still there. But of course, that was a good idea to begin with. So like, it's, VR was never a good thing to do at a convention, but it was kind of worth it, you know, in a lot of ways. But maybe now we'll give up on that, which is a little sad. It is interesting that arcades have been dying for decades in a sense, but like they've been reinvented and rethought and, you know, there's been, and like video game installations are so fascinating to take, you know, console style experiences and then adding, you know, real world location based stuff, either as temporary as a permanent sort of thing. And the future of that, I don't know.
Publisher Simon & Schuster got in on the text adventure trend with a series of games in the late 80s, like the Kobayashi Alternative and the Promethean Prophecy. So the text games are still happening at that point. In the 90s, with the debut of Star Trek The Next Generation and the Trek boom of the 90s, a lot of video games followed suit. 1992 saw the release of Star Trek 25th Anniversary with a sequel called Judgment Rites that came out the next year. And they were both developed by Interplay, which old video game heads will recognize that developer. And they are point-and-click style adventure games.
Yeah, those are, when I was mentioning earlier, like the ones that feel a little bit clunky, a little bit obtuse. This is those categories a little bit.
Yeah.
Judgment Rites, I think, came off a little better than some of these other ones. It's also the last appearance of the entire original crew on a single project. Because it came out after Generations, which didn't have the whole crew, but that was after Star Trek VI. And so that has an interesting place in Star Trek history. It's the last time the whole crew was together.
Yeah. And as far as the design of it goes, you know, we talked about like what makes a Star Trek game. I do think that the episodic design and nature of the game really helps that. You know, it's divided and they don't really call them levels, but I guess it's kind of like levels where there's like seven or eight scenarios and each one of them has a title, like a Star Trek episode.
Yes.
And each one features the Enterprise going to a specific planet and dealing with something and needing to find clues to solve, you know, whatever the problem is.
That is a great model for a Star Trek game. And I'm actually kind of surprised. Well, there was a sequel planned that didn't get released, right? Secret of Vulcan Fury that used a similar model. It was written by Dorothy Fontana and sort of tragically unfinished. But I think maybe that's the reason why that model, that sort of episodic mission model for a Star Trek game didn't really resurface, is to my memory anyway. But it's such a great idea. Because you can do that kind of thing where you can tell a bunch of different tales. You could build up to a larger theme. I think Judgment Rites had a kind of like a finale in a sense as well, right? Mm-hmm. The one there's one from that era that I think Simon and Schuster, maybe it wasn't, Spectrum Holobyte made the next generation of Final Unity, which was basically just a Star Trek episode that was kind of a point and click. That's a game I played. I had the strategy guide for that one. I love that. And I think that was made after TNG went off the air. But it just felt like a season 4, season 5 episode. It was really cool.
Yeah, that was, I never got to play that one. I did play Star Trek Echoes from the Past for the Sega Genesis. I think there was an NES version called Futures Past. And that was like the dark side of what we're talking about. Like I felt, you know, I never got through the game and I don't remember if there was an instruction manual or not, but all the idea was to give you the feeling that you were the commander of the Enterprise D and you could, you know, go into the data bank, and it had all these like things that would have been really interesting in a well-developed like modern game, like a database, the ability to fly to, you know, 1 of 1,000 planets. But the NES or the SNES control interface was just so leaden, and trying to get to where you're going, and they say, go to this planet. And if you go to Beta 5 instead of Beta 6, then you're just, you know, there's nothing there. And
yeah,
it was just not very rewarding.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You really want, as a game designer, you want to have like, you want it to feel real, which means it has to have more places to go than places you need to go. Sure. It needs to have systems that are more complicated than what you need to task to complete right now, to feel real, like there's a bigger world, to imply a bigger world. But at the same time, that's going to make it tedious and boring. Like, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
That's a fine line to walk. There's lots of tricks you have to do to sort of make that feel intuitive, to give the player the impression that they're a real Starfleet officer who knows how to use this equipment, and not someone fumbling around on their Super Nintendo controller trying to remember which button does what, you know?
Yeah. And these are all games that feature, you know, you're on the ship and you fly somewhere and then you usually beam down. In 1993 or 94, we got Star Trek Deep Space Nine Crossroads of Time, which was a side-scroller for the Genesis and the NES.
Yeah, my favorite fact about that is something I think about a lot. When I didn't play that when it was new, but I played it some years ago, and I think that's a great game. Great game is maybe overselling it. There's good things about it. One, the story is interesting. It's really enmeshed in that first two seasons of DS9 Bajoran politics stuff, which like I love that. And one of the things that DS9 is my favorite Star Trek, but I do kind of wish they'd stuck with that and did less Dominion stuff. As much as I also like that, I think they lost a lot of Bajoran politics, which I adored that in the first couple seasons. And that was when it was released, so it's around that time. The thing that's so interesting to me is that you play as Sisko running around the station, defusing bombs and knocking people out in the side scroll. It's just the game is way too hard. But Sisko's not wearing a comm badge. And the reason is because you need to be able to flip that sprite to reverse it so he's going left or right.
Oh,
and there's not enough system memory. So they decided, rather than have half the time, because it's very much a backtracking kind of game, so you do move left as often as you move right.
Yeah.
And so they decided that it was just not worth it to put the comm badge on. So low resolution enough, you could just kind of imagine it's there. And the thing about that was so interesting to me, as a game designer, thinking about like holistic design, like making sure all the pieces come together is, okay, it's 1993, it's the Sega Genesis. We can't have two whole sets of player sprites. I get it. But maybe we should. Like, maybe we can have one fewer enemy, which is going to make the game not as fun. Or maybe we'll have one fewer level, which will make the game shorter and not as good, perhaps. But I think that's worth it in this case, right? Because to make that flip sprite for the Sisko character, because that emblem is so important. And it feels so trivial. Like, if you're, because, you know, this is a licensed game, I'm sure someone made that choice of saying, like, listen, this is a good solution. We'll just drop that off and you'll just kind of pretend it's there. And then we won't have that weird backwardsness. But I feel that in this particular example, they missed out on what's important about the sort of iconography of Star Trek. And it just,
interesting.
I don't know that I'm really hung up on that, about like how nobody thought that had any value, when I would say that has in other games. I totally agree. Like, you know, if you have a character with an asymmetrical outfit and you flip the sprite and it looks backwards, that's kind of fine. Like, you can get away with that just without making a separate set of sprites.
Yeah.
But I think in this case, I think that it feels like a lesson to me about like what's important when you make games. And it is going to, it depends on all that context, you know?
Yeah. 94 was a big year for Trek games. We also got Star Trek, Starfleet Academy, Starship Bridge Simulator, wow, for the SNES and Sega 32X, which was similar to the TOS Interplay games, just a sort of upgraded graphical interface. And 1996 is where things sort of start to break off. You know, 1996 brought us Star Trek Klingon and Star Trek Borg from Simon & Schuster. And these are both like, you know, take the board game out of the VHS game. You know, they feature interactive movies, choose your own adventure style games.
It's definitely better than the VHS board game. Star Trek Klingon was directed by Jonathan Frakes, which is very cool. And it featured a lot of the background actors who played Klingons in other episodes. They got to have speaking roles, and it was a little bit, and I think Gowron does make an appearance in that one as well. It's a pretty simple choose your own adventure game. So it's more depth than the VCR game, but not by much. But, the best thing about that game is it had a third disc, which was the Klingon Language Lab, which was a interactive Klingon dictionary that, that it came from, you know, from the published Klingon dictionary, but it was actually a little, it was like Duolingo for Klingon, you know, 25 years before Duolingo. And that's one I definitely had, you know, in its era. And I remember playing through that. And that's from a whole range of Simon & Schuster games that were kind of edutainment, kind of like, there was the Star Trek interactive technical manual, which you could walk around the Enterprise with these. It's actually the best representation of the Enterprise sets, because there's lots of, they did this QuickTime VR, which is the silly name, but it's the name for the 360 video from the mid 90s. And you could walk around a low resolution, but still the best views of certain sets of the Next Generation. And Simon & Schuster, like their video games for Star Trek, the whole time they had the license, always had a little bit of a serious bent to them. And as a kid who didn't love other children's programming and was like, I was kind of born age 30. Like those were the games for me. I love the Simon & Schuster stuff, which is sort of why, maybe it's partly why when I feel something like Voyager Elite Force, I'm a little bit more dismissive of that, because I'm like, where's the extra disc where I get to read the codex about all the Delta Quadrant species?
And in Elite Force, you know, they've pretty much modeled a lot of Voyager anyway. So why can't I just like walk around and explore?
Yeah, it's a good looking game.
Voyager. The days of FMV. Every video game had to cram a bunch of video in there. Star Trek Deep Space Nine Harbinger came out in 1996. In that game, the player takes control of a new character, Envoy Bannock, and interacts with the crew of the station in a puzzle-type adventure, similar to games like The 11th Hour. So in this case, you know, it's all voiced by the actors from the show, but you are just playing, you know, new guy who gets to interact with them instead of you being Sisko.
That's one I wish I had played. I haven't played that one yet. There's another DS9 game that's similar called The Fallen. Which is also... Avery Brooks didn't appear in that one. I think it had a sound alike, but everybody else showed up. That one is interesting because it's compare that to Elite Force, where the they're both shooters, but The Fallen is a little bit more, a little more RPG-ish, a little more story going on, trying a little harder. And of course, Simon & Schuster made it. So that might be why. The other interesting game developer fact about this that I don't know how much, it's interesting to me anyway, is Elite Force was made with the Quake 3 engine. And The Fallen was made with the Unreal Tournament engine. And so, and those two engines at the time, right now, if you're a game developer, an indie game developer, especially, the options you, the sort of big engines you can choose from to build your game in are Unity and Unreal. And Unreal has a lineage that goes all the way back to Unreal Tournament. And back then it was competing with the Quake engine. So those Unreal and Quake licensed their engines to different companies to make different games, and they competed. And there was lots of internet arguments over which one was better from gamers who didn't understand the difference. What I find so fascinating about that, it's a little bit like Voyager and DS9 are so, it's so perfect that Voyager chose one and DS9 chose the other.
It just
seems so appropriate for like that era of Star Trek, like how different those shows are, you know, but ostensibly to an outsider they're the same, you know.
They're both very entertaining games, but that I love that dichotomy. adventure seems to be the genre that Trek is going to in this period. You know, we get games in 97 like Star Trek Starfleet Academy, which is a simulation game. We also get 1997 Star Trek Generations, which was a first-person shooter from Microprose that was based on the theatrical film. I never played that one. I think the premiere, I haven't even heard of that one. Huh. Yeah, the premier Trek FPS, you know, would be Elite Force, obviously. But yeah, I wasn't unfamiliar with that. And then, of course, 1998 gives us Star Trek Pinball. And we haven't even touched on pinball yet. Of course, Trek has had machines since 1979 when the first Bally machine came out for Star Trek Pinball. You know, other than those detours into different genres, adventure seems to be where Trek lands up until the point where it sort of goes off into real-time strategy and a bit of simulation. In 1998, Star Trek Starship Creator came out. I don't know if you're familiar with Starship Creator, but...
I'm familiar with Starship Creator.
Okay, all right. It's for people who don't know, it's a weird little title that I think was kind of critically panned, but I know that I enjoyed. You get to basically like build your own starships, and then you get to like send them off and like do little things. It's sort of like a... like an early idle game, kind of, where your ship just goes off on its own.
Man, if everyone, it's Kit Bash the video game.
And,
you know, as fans, you saw all the like the models that were made from other parts in the backgrounds of Next Generation episodes.
Yeah.
And what's great is that it developed a little in-universe lore about like that's how starships are built. They have a hull, they have nacelles, they have the saucer, and you can and they are interchangeable to a degree. And there's like a mystery, like what, how does that work in the engineering labs, like at Space Dock? How do they make those decisions? Are these refits? Or and like Starship Creator just got to let you play with that, which was so cool. Another one from, you know, my friends at Simon & Schuster.
Starfleet Command came out in 1999. It's a real-time space battle game with no story mode. It's just sort of versus. And I remember many frustrating nights of LAN parties trying to get this to work for six players.
I've never heard of that one.
It's this, you know, simulation battle type thing. You get to be the Romulans or the Federation and pit their ships against each other. Star Trek Hidden Evil was in 1999, and that's a third person action game based on the events of Star Trek Insurrection. And I don't remember this one at all, but
I think it's
significant as it's one of, if not the first of the Trek third person action games. Another one is, of course, what we mentioned before, DS9's The Fallen. I remember playing The Fallen. I loved The Fallen, and I wish that it would end up on Good Old Games, you know, or something like that, because it is, it's almost impossible to make work, you know, on a modern machine.
Right. DS9 has had an interesting revival in the past 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
Like Star Trek fans are like, oh, it's the middle child or whatever. But I think as you know, Star Trek went to Netflix, I think it's found a whole new audience. I think that game, particularly because it's, you know, one of the better examples, it really should be revived, as you described. That would be
good. I think so. In 2000 we get Star Trek Armada, which is one of the first RTS games for Trek, which is a genre I think Trek is probably well suited for.
There ended up being a couple of those, and some of that rolled into the way Star Trek Online works, and there's a little bit of the sort of fantasy of just piloting a ship is pretty cool. A couple of console games that use that as well.
Gathering resources, getting dilithium crystals and things like that. 2000 and 2001 were big years for Trek video games. We got Star Trek Klingon Academy, Star Trek New Worlds, Starfleet Command 2, and Starship Creator 2, and Star Trek Invasion, which this, every time I go to a con, I always check all the merch tables. I'm always looking for a copy of Star Trek Invasion because I've never played it, but it's by the same team who developed Colony Wars, which is one of my favorite space shooter sims on early PlayStation. Want to get my hands on that real bad. And then, of course, in 2000, we get Elite Force, which features the entire cast of Voyager doing the voices. I just posted the final chapter in my Let's Play series of Elite Force on YouTube, and you can find that on the Just Enough Trip YouTube channel. That game got a sequel in 2003. Also in 2001, we got Star Trek Away Team, which was a real-time tactics game in the style of your Syndicates or your Desperados, which seems like it could be a good fit. It seems like at this point, after we've gone through all these genres, the strategy is just to throw Trek into every genre possible and see what works.
Yeah, that's the thing about Star Trek games is, one, kind of was saying at the top, like it really reflects how incompatible Star Trek is to like the motivations that govern game players. And I think, and so some of the better examples are ones that either take a more nuanced approach or really take the Star Trek-y part of it seriously enough to change those mechanics to fit it. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that these games reflect is just like the eras in which what were popular, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Because you kind of, it's easy to just sort of like treat Star Trek as a coat of paint on some of these. And then it reveals what was popular in 2002, what was popular in 1996. Like, and it kind of like, oh, this is just what was going on. And more than other games of those eras, which feel a little bit more of their, you know, a lot of them, even though if they were trend followers, a lot have a lot of their own unique qualities. Whereas sometimes the Star Trek games are just like, this is what's happening. And it's kind of an interesting little way to view video game history.
That's, what's going on in Trek definitely influences how the games come out. I mean, in the mid-aughts, Trek leaves TV. And so the games start to kind of dry up and we don't get like multiple releases per year. In the mid-aughts, though, we did get Star Trek Bridge Commander, Tactical Assault, Legacy, and Encounters, all of which were for consoles because, of course, consoles are taking the market over at this point. Yeah. Star Trek Conquest, which is a strategy game, came out in 2007. Star Trek DAC, which was a multiplayer combat game, came out in 2009 to coincide with the release of the J.J. Abrams movie. And likewise, the third-person action game, just simply Star Trek, comes out in 2013 to coincide with the release of Into Darkness.
That
a bad film, and from all accounts, a pretty bad game.
Yeah, so the thing about that game is it's like it's an interquel between the 2009 and Into
Which
Darkness.
Is a good... It's probably a good thing to do. It's a good instinct.
Yeah, it has its own unique story. It involves the Gorn, which is kind of fun. Yeah. It had a really cool ad campaign where William Shatner was in it, and the guy in the original Gorn costume was playing with him in a living room. So very cute, very Shatner. I don't hate that game. It's not good. The story's not great. The mechanics are. It's very a Gears of War kind of third person cover shooter action game. But I kind of don't mind. Like same way like mediocre Star Trek is still Star Trek. Like the thing about this game is like, it's kind of bad, but like who cares? Like it's okay. Like it's not committing any crimes, you know?
Sure. Yeah, I'll have to give it another chance. I think I played a demo or saw a video or something and thought not for me, but I'll have to give it a chance.
They were planning on, so this was the era of the PlayStation Move, which was the PlayStation's copying the Wii remote. This is before VR, so which used the Move controllers. There was a plan to make this game, make a phaser peripheral for the PlayStation Move to sell with this game, you know, which was a bad idea. I'm glad they didn't do it.
In 2010, of course, Star Trek Online is released, and that gives us one of Trek's longest running and arguably most successful games. Are you a Star Trek Online player?
You know, I will tell you, when Star Trek Online was announced, it was announced in 2005, I want to say.
Wow.
And 2004. It was announced in 2004. I was in college at the time, and I was reintroducing myself to Star Trek, right? And getting obsessed with it again. And so I was on the message boards for Perpetual Entertainment, which was the company that announced Star Trek Online. And I didn't play World of Warcraft. I didn't really know how MMOs were supposed to work. And so I was just on the forum with these other Star Trek fans. Some of them were game players, some of them weren't. And we just talked about what it was going to be like to live on a starship. The plan originally was that you would be an ensign on a starship. You'd be assigned tasks. You would be the eventual game that was released was a lot more practical and realistic, where you get your own ship right away. Even if you're an ensign, you're still captain of that ship. Like a lot more. But man, it originally had these big, big ideas. There was a ton of discussion on those message boards about credits and in-game money. And like, you know, like, are you going to start at the academy? Are you going to play 20 hours at the academy before you get to, you know, assigned to an Excelsior class in the lower decks of the Excelsior or whatever?
God, that's so
and just all this, we really wanted to do this like role playing, and it just how naive we all were when the game finally came out. And it's actually quite loving in its appreciation of Star Trek. But at the same time, that game has 7 types of currency. It commits all the sins of MMOs. And as a game developer, part of it offends me a little bit that like they took this property and just glommed on all the MMO mechanics. And so if you play World of Warcraft, if you play Final Fantasy XIV, you'll play Star Trek. And if you like Star Trek, it's a great experience. But if you just like Star Trek, and even if you do like Star Trek and video games, it's a little hard to digest. But it is full of tons of fan references. You got to see Captain Nog really early in the game, voiced by Aaron Eisenberg, which is great, especially now that he's gone. They keep bringing back actors to do little fun things, and it's all, if you have the dog-eared copy of the Star Trek Encyclopedia, you are rolling your eyes constantly at Star Trek Online. But like, and the currency thing is, I would say, unforgivable in terms of it being a Star Trek game. Yeah. But it's a lot of fun. It really does love Star Trek in a way that, like, it does feel like Star Trek theme park, you know?
That's so, it's so interesting that you and your friends were all thinking in terms of like simulation, right? Or or role play. Like, this is what we want. Like, we all want to be in Star Trek. So obviously this game is going to like let us live this life of Star Trek.
We're all going to go and have poker nights. Like, it was just, we were so naive. We really thought that was going to be like.
And here I am in like 2021 and my Romulan Republic officer is being asked by Laurel to help the Klingons with their thing. And I'm like, why do I have to do that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's video games are just that now. Like, all the Star Trek mobile games mix up all the IP of it. Every Marvel game that is not story based is just trading cards, basically, where you have everything from everything. And it's playing with a bucket of toys. And I think that's okay. Like, it's not my speed, but I think that's a perfectly fine way to approach an IP. But it is weird, for Star Trek in particular, because of how. Because we are the original nitpickers, to just throw all that out and say, like, put on a purple uniform, it's fine. Like, it's like, okay, like, I guess purple's fun. Like, how are you, like, it's so, I mean, I never want to tell anyone to not have fun, but part of me is like,
sure,
maybe we shouldn't have Latinum in this game. Like, we shouldn't use Latinum to buy a warp nacelle upgrade. Like, that feels wrong. Like,
I
don't know, I feel like a humbug about it sometimes.
Well, we all have our opinions. We didn't talk much about mobile games, but you're right. Games like Timelines or Trexels or even Fleet Command, which is still going strong. It's Khan, versus alternate universe, somebody or other. They just combine all the elements together. Star Trek's obviously, a successful franchise with a fan base that likes video games, but there doesn't seem to be much going on. I mean, there's nothing major in development right now, as far as I can tell. Star Trek Adversaries was a virtual CC game that was shut down because, we don't know why because, but it's just not going anymore. And there's nothing really on the horizon. Like, why do you think there's so little movement currently on bringing Trek games to consumers?
I think, so Bridge Crew came out a couple years ago, and Star Trek Ascendancy, which is a $100 board game, you're going to have to give me a minute to get into that, because I love that game.
Okay.
And then Star Trek Adventures, which is a role-playing game, a pen and paper, roll your die role-playing game. That is going pretty strong right now, but it came out a while ago. They're doing updates and expansions and stuff. But I think you are right. There isn't like a big... Bridge Crew was really the last big one, right? The big big mainstream. Ubisoft made it and put a lot of support into it because it was very popular. And Star Trek Online, I guess, has never been more popular. But like, those are all going concerns, right? There isn't anything. I mean, maybe there's something planned. But I think part of it is, as a licensed property, there needs to be some kind of hook to bring a general audience like, oh, yeah, I saw that Star Trek movie. I'll play that Star Trek game. It's a little harder, I think, to say, like, I've been watching Discovery and enjoying it. I'll play a Discovery game. Like, even though it feels like the same conversation, I think that's a little harder sell, because it's, like, where's that story going to take place? Like, it's a little easier to do these kinds of video game spinoffs when there's something, when there's like events, right? And I think Star Trek has now again become this just rolling machine. And I think it's probably a little bit to do with that. I also think that licensed games generally that are not mobile games are on their way out. Like, there used to be that every movie that came out had a video game that was released on the same day, right?
Yeah, right.
And they were all pretty bad usually.
Right.
But if you like that property, you could have a good time with it. They were always, they always had to meet a deadline. So the developers were always they had to cut a lot of features at the last minute. And, movie schedules change and they don't care what that does to the poor Activision sub-studio that's responsible for it, for the tie-in. But like,
or a claim. Depends on what year we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah. it is interesting how sometimes something will be delayed. And then, especially in this past 2 years with the pandemic, the movies have been delayed, but then tie-in media kind of gets released eventually around it or something, like a comic book or you know, some sort of a mobile game or something like that. But generally, like big action games don't really get tied into the release of these properties anymore. So they need to sort of live on their own merits. And so that's like a harder conversation to have. And I guess if I'm developing a game at a studio, I kind of just want to make my own thing. I don't really want to make, I want to make a Star Trek game, but also I kind of don't. I kind of just want to make my own thing inspired by my love of Star Trek rather than, as much as everyone wants to get their hands on properties, I think there's less motivation to make these things. Unless you have a really cool core idea like Star Trek Bridge Crew, which was just a good enough idea that it made sense. It made more sense to make that a Star Trek game than to make it a unique property. You know what I mean?
That's so interesting because it's such a huge universe and nobody has ever needed an excuse to make a Star Wars game. But like something like something like Fallen Order, which came out recently, which I know it had problems and bugs and things like that. But it's like it was such a strong story that didn't necessarily really tie into anything that was going on in the films or any extended properties. And it was so the story at least was so well accepted that they're, you know, looking at possibly, you know, it has been licensed. I think an option to be a movie. And that's something that they didn't, I'm sure they made a ton of money, you know, releasing that game and it didn't have to be made. It wasn't necessarily tied to anything. I just feel like that this is part of like what I said earlier about how I think Star Trek needs to diversify so that they could have an element, an area of the universe, a character or a show that they could just do something like this. Like if you had made Elite Force now, it could have really taken off and then we could like make an Elite Force show, you know, or an Elite Force movie or something like that.
Yeah, interesting. So the Star Wars is a good comparison because it's the different relationship to the expanded universe, right? Like there was that Shadows of the Empire for Nintendo 64.
Yeah.
That was just like a Han Solo type, but not Han Solo.
Yeah.
And like, and I don't think you could do that with Star Trek. I think I don't see why not exactly, but it's harder for me to imagine a Star Trek game because Star Trek is a big universe and you could have your own spin-off in the Star Trek universe, but just make it a video game like that. Like just like you were saying, then it could later inspire other things. That seems like a good idea for Star Trek, but I have a little harder time imagining it. I almost want like a Cooking Mama game, but it's like one of the promenade vendors or something.
Okay.
Like I almost think that would be better than say like the adventures of the USS whatever. Like, I think that'd be a harder sell for people. It's a little easier to be like, here's a Star Wars game starring a new character, but there's a lightsaber and a droid that he travels with. And it's like, that feels a little bit more just like closer to what Star Wars is. Like that's, I mean, the core of Star Wars is its props basically. So maybe.
Well, that's
I think with Star Trek, it's a little harder to say, here's a person with four pips and a phaser and they beam places. I don't think that's as attractive to someone who like, I think, does that make sense? I don't know. Maybe that's not true. I don't know.
What would the Star Trek Dark Souls game be like?
Yeah.
You fail to scan the thing in time or something like they have to do it again. Well, developers can have trouble translating the feel of Star Trek to video games, as we've discussed, but can you think of any mainstream games or indie games that capture a similar feeling to Star Trek?
Oh, that's a really good question. I don't think so. I think, and that's a bit of a concern I have. One of the things that I feel as a developer, and I'll just plug my own work. So if you'll allow me, I put out a game in 2019 called Widget Satchel, which is a game where you play as a ferret on a space station causing mischief. So not very Star Trek-like.
Yeah.
But the station is this remote outpost, and I did a lot of world building in the game that is revealed as you sort of wander through. And the idea is that it's a very Star Trek kind of place. And what I wanted to do with that is not just give it a coat of paint of Star Trek or like, you know, it's Federation, but called something different. I wanted to imply to the player that this is a universe where there aren't big enemies, where there isn't a big bad. You're just goofing off on a ship, right? And the human characters who are your obstacles in the game, they're the people who will put you back in your playpen. They're not your enemies. And I think that's one of the things that I love about Star Trek is the idea that, like, you know, in another universe, we could be friends, right? I think that's such a powerful, if cliched at this point, message. But I don't think we see enough of that in video games, which are very much based on defeat the enemy, beat your friends, knock down the tower, like, destroy the thing, win the war. Like, that is so... Yeah. Core to what games are, because they're competition in a lot of ways. Yeah. And I feel as a developer, I'm much more interested in games being an avenue for story. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have competition or you can't have fierce competition, but I want to make things where I don't want players to treat it to take that part of it seriously, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think so with Widget Satchel, the game, you run around, you knock crap over, like you are clumsy, you explode things, but you don't you don't destroy anything in a sense. And so the game has a kind of a tone that is very in a lot of ways inspired by Star Trek's kind of approach, which is that, you know, the Picard can go to a planet and there's a big conflict, even though he could solve it with one photon torpedo.
Yeah.
And I think, like, you know, I'm not taking exactly those scenarios from Star Trek, but I think I do want to see more games that take those kinds of thoughts about, like, it isn't just about what's possible, or isn't it about one force versus another force, who has the higher number, who rolls the best, status check on the 20-sided die, and much more about choices and self-regulation. And I don't know, these are kind of like, they can feel like ideas that are too big and too a little bit too hoity-toity for video games, but yeah. They shouldn't be, right? We talk about that stuff in other media, but that's part. I guess that's part of why, you know, I try to put as much of that in Widget Satchel. But it's a small game. I'm an indie developer, so it has a small scale. But I don't see a lot of other games kind of embracing that notion of moving outside the language of. I mean, we're not doing high scores anymore, but that's still what video games feel like in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that exactly. It's just, I feel there's more we could do, you know? And Star Trek feels like a good inspiration to find out what more we could do.
Yeah, that cooperative element is certainly thin on the ground in most games.
Yeah.
I would put a word in for The Outer Wilds, which I feel like is a game that has, you know, so much of it is literally about space travel, but also just about exploration and sort of putting the pieces together of a narrative that you learn more about, you know, the deeper that you go into the world.
Yeah, yeah. There's a cynicism, I think, in that game.
That's true. That's
that
true.
I feel. And so, but, you know, that's the thing, is a different dimensions, right? It Star Trek is the least cynical thing ever, but that doesn't mean you couldn't have something that has that feeling and add some cynicism to it. So I think that's all right.
They're doing all these, they're like branding Minecraft in all these ways now. If there's not a Star Trek Minecraft, then somebody should get fired. Like, you cooperate, you build things, you know, you could just skin it as, you know, phasers and things like that, and batleths instead of pitchforks or whatever they've got.
Yeah, and
somebody at Viacom's got to get that going.
There's a whole genre of games which is just about creation, right? Fortnite has a little bit of this with this creative mode. I don't have a lot of great things to say about Fortnite, but it does have some great stuff in it. Minecraft, Dreams is a great PS4 game that, like, just lets you make anything you want. And that kind of spirit of creation. And Star Trek is not really about, like, you know, about that exactly. But I think you could find something in that type of, like, Minecraft does feel like a good license opportunity, because you slap the Star Trek coat of paint on it and be done. But also, Minecraft is about exploration and creation and in a lot of ways cooperation and, like, PvE kind of, you know. And so, like, it does seem like an appropriate fit compared to other types of slap a skin on it kind of games that you could use the Star Trek license for.
Yeah, I think so. I'd love to run into a horda in the caves instead of a creeper.
Yeah, and of course maybe you kill one, but then you learn that it's that it can help you.
It carves out no exactly kill right. eye in blocks.
Well, exactly right.
Well, Mark, it's been great talking with you. I love video games. I love Star Trek. I'm hoping that the current TV renaissance of Trek can lead to a similar resurgence of some good Star Trek video games. Where can people find you and Nice Games Club online?
Well, you can listen to Nice Games Club, nicegames.club, or anywhere you get your podcasts. We do roundtables. We do interviews. We do game jams. And I do talk about Star Trek quite a bit on that show. So you should, my co-host Ellen is also a big fan, and our other co-host Steven, he's learning the ways. So you can follow his journey at nicegames.club, and you can find the work I do as a game developer, noblerobot.com.
Noblerobot.com. All right. Well, thanks again for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.